welcome to Zapshin Ratatzi and Yvonne Ridley, joining you from on board HMS President in the heart of the English capital.
And the theme today is intervention. Is it a force for good? That's what the West says about its military intervention in Libya, although not everyone is convinced, including the Turkish Prime Minister who dropped by the capital a few days ago.
Someone else who swung by for a more permanent stay is Colonel Gaddafi's foreign minister. But why should his arrival be more of a cause for concern? This expert on military machinations comes on board to explain.
And while there's a mixed reaction to military intervention in Libya, this seasoned journalist says a no-fly zone in Gaza to protect unarmed civilians there would be most welcome.
Although military intervention led by Saudi forces into the tiny island kingdom of Bahrain is not something this peace campaigner and human rights activist wanted.
Today's show will also revisit the crisis in Japan, as this guest explains why the people there are probably more psychologically equipped to deal with the catastrophes thrown at them than any other population.
All of this and so much more, so stay tuned to the show which rocks the boat. Our first guest is a Bahraini human rights activist. It seems rather than calm things down, the flurry of funerals of protesters killed in clashes with government forces continues to cause unrest.
Welcome, Abbas Al-Omran. We've seen some heartbreaking scenes coming out of Bahrain, especially the recent funeral of the 15-year-old boy who was shot dead by government forces. What is happening on the ground now?
After applying the martial law at 15th of March and Saudi invaders, they would like to kick, they would like to ban everything and not allow for anybody to protest. While that, and the other hand of that one, the people tried to, the youth of 14th of February revolution tried to challenge that the new equation.
Is the revolution finished now? Is it over?
No, it is not finished. There is a day. There is a weekly program and a daily protest. And as an example, today is on a Friday. There will be, they call it a Friday of anger, and the protest everywhere called in Bahrain.
And this is every Friday in Bahrain.
It is in every day. There is a Quran marching. There is a candle vision marching. There is funeral marching.
And of course, people are dying on these demonstrations. The Americans, the British, they're big public relations companies trying to keep this out of the news, in the big media, as it were. How successful do you think they are? Because I don't see much about Bahrain on the news.
I don't think so. They will succeed. The U.S. said we don't like to sit in the opposite, in the wrong side of the history. Actually, the Bahraini people just would like to, from the U.S. not to interfere in our affairs. What you want from them only not to support the Bahraini regime by two things: don't give him the weapons, and they use it to kill the people, especially the tankers and the Apache and the fire guns. And the other thing, to stop playing under the table to support.
Do you think the protesters could demonstrate outside the 5th Fleet Air Base, Naval Base?
Actually, the Bahraini people looking for them rights, especially the democratic rights. The other things that I would like, the other interest for the U.S. for the 5th Fleet, which was like to impose it in the Bahrain case, definitely if the U.S. not taking it's not taking the right action with the nations, which will at the end will win, that the 5th Fleet definitely will be affected. Because the people, they are very angry about the U.S.
Of course, one of the criticisms is that the people who are revolting are not representative of Bahrainis. We do try and invite the Bahrain embassy to send officials. They never respond. But, you know, why are we not hearing the other voice?
They would like to depending everything and control the news coming from inside, and they kicked off all the representative of the international the media. As an example, the CNN representative yesterday was arrested and kicked off of Bahrain. as so many of media international have been kicked off. If you ask them to come outside and talk with the media, definitely the people will discover them weakness and them lying.
Well, we hope they come on anyway.
Yes,
either
if they're
way.
Watching.
Thank you very much for coming on board.
Thank you.
Japan still remains very much at the top of the agenda, and while scientists, emergency services and charities continue to do their work, our next guest talks about the research study she has carried out on the people who survived the quake, tsunami and nuclear fallout. This is what she had to say. Professor Joffe, welcome to HMS President. You've been working at a very different angle on the earthquake in Japan, as it were, or anticipation of earthquakes more generally. What were your findings about perceptions of earthquake fear, risk, and so on?
Yes, we were, as you say, looking at it well before this earthquake, but looking at people's mindset as they think about earthquakes. And interestingly, of course, in Japan there's a lot of experience of past earthquakes from Kobe to many others, and that really influences how they think about future earthquakes. So there's a lot of talk and thought about loss and damage.
You found more fatalism in Japan than, say, in Southern California?
We did. We found a lot more fatalism. And I think it's important to state that while there was strong sense of fatalism, it does run alongside a fair amount of preparedness. So people are doing both. They have a notion that the elements will take over in an earthquake. But it doesn't mean that they don't then also prepare themselves and take personal responsibility for their households in
what
relation
to... What I found fascinating was the demeanour of the Japanese people. They maintained, in dire circumstances, a dignity which you don't often see in the aftermath of earthquakes, where law and order completely breaks down and looting and pillaging and crime sprees follow.
I think firstly that idea that looting and crime sprees follow is not corroborated in many disasters. You find that people do pull together and there is a very strong community feeling, but I think that's is a good point, because in Japan, say, as compared to the other cities that we studied, which were in the US and Turkey, we found in them thinking about a potential earthquake, there was absolutely no talk of anarchy, pillaging, looting, and clearly that had not been the experience in Kobe at all. So it was absent from our data, where it was present in terms of, certainly Americans were talking about Katrina rather than talking about an earthquake. But I think there is a sense that they trust their society to pull through. And
so how are the Americans different? I mean, culturally, Kurosawa, film director in Japan, film directors in America, they seem to both have a fatalist idea, environmental perspective perhaps, but you found that Americans treated earthquake fear differently.
Yeah, I think you find a stronger optimism in Americans, because they have a sense that they can kind of master whatever problems face them. So I think you do find that would be a stronger angle there, that you wouldn't find as much in Japan. Though that's not to say that Japanese, I'd like to state again, don't do a lot to prepare themselves for earthquakes. We were looking in Seattle, which is on a fault line, but actually, fortunately, hasn't had any serious earthquakes in recent years. And we found that there was a sense that it wouldn't happen here, a much stronger sense that it wouldn't happen here, whereas with our Japanese people...
But we
people,
know it will.
But the time spans of earthquakes are massive, you know. We're talking, you know, within 350 years it is likely to happen. But
where will your research take you now?
Well, we're working, it's a large funded project that works with engineers, and so we need to think about some sort of mix of thinking about the psychology of the people in the buildings with the structures and how you build structures. So we need to take forward some of the thoughts. The engineering is both tsunami and earthquake structures linked, and ours is more psychological, and we've done separate studies and we need to find out how to bring them together.
Well, thank you very much. What prescient research.
Thank you. Pleasure.
All you must go out. This is the end. You must go out.
And freedom! 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 Freedom!
The departure of Hosni Mubarak seems a long time ago now, but our next guest is a former journalist who is researching Islam and nationalism at the London School of Economics.
Welcome, Mansour Mirza. You've studied Egypt, you were a journalist in Egypt. What about the role of Islam in the revolutionary politics of Egypt as it is today? Because as far as we saw it on television, it was all about Facebook.
Well, historically, Islam has always been kind of part of the revolutions in Egypt that have happened before, so in 1882, in 1919, and indeed in 1952, Islam was very much a part of those revolutions. What was different about this revolution was when it started to emerge, Islam didn't appear to be at the forefront of the revolution. It was indeed about Facebook, Twitter, the youth opposition movement, the very much demands for Mubarak to go, very much secular demands. But as time has gone on, I think that you can see Islam coming more and more into the focus, into the concerns of people and concerns of the revolution, and actually taking much, much more of a role. So the Muslim Brotherhood now are much more prominent in whatever's going on in Egypt, the changing situation, and people are talking about, for instance, the referendum recently. People were talking about, you know, Muslim Brotherhood certainly were talking about the yes vote being a religious duty of
Egyptians. Well, the corporate media seem to have said Egypt, been there, done that, everything's on the road to peace and democracy. What are the dangers? Because I understand that a lot of the old regime is still there. Presumably they're worrying quite a lot about opposition movements and Islamic nationalism, as it were, taking over Egypt, which of course is still so strategically important, what with the Suez Canal, the Nile River.
Yeah, you know, Egypt has got a long way to go yet. There is a huge problem still in terms of, you know, the emergence of political parties over there. Of course, the army, in a sense, not in a sense, but in a very real sense, are still very much in control. So the military council are in control. And many people are sort of saying that it's going to be very difficult for the army to be sidelined or to move aside and let some sort of a civilian government come around. So Egypt is not through the fence yet. I mean, there's a lot of hard work to go and there's a lot of challenges that still remain.
You're also studying nationalism, and of course there has been a degree of nationalism written into the new constitution, hasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in terms of the president, and you know, I thought that the clause about the president cannot be married to a non-Egyptian, I thought that was quite interesting. That was a very nationalist kind of clause to bring along. But I think that we should also not lose sight of the other things that have happened within the constitution, which is that, you know, presidential powers are looking to they're looking to limit the term. They're looking to bring in a vice president. There is also a big change in terms of political parties and the setting up of political parties. But these are all, yes, sort of very nationalist kind of amendments to the constitution. And of course, the revolution itself is a nationalist revolution.
And who's drawing up the constitution? I mean, are the young revolutionaries who formed part of the committee in those heady days in Tahrir Square, are they drawing up the constitution? Are they getting a say?
I think that's part of the problem at the moment that they feel. So recently with the referendum, many of the people from the youth opposition movement, the young secular liberals, were very much campaigning for a no vote. They feel that their demands have not been taken into account in drawing up these new constitutional amendments. So they feel very much sidelined out from the whole thing. So they were very much talking about...
So they could be back out there on Tahrir Square. Just finally, where's the money? Because Mubarak, as we know, Sharm el-Sheikh, where is all the money going?
Well, you know, the money, you'll hear all kinds of different sort of things about, you know, some people were sort of talking 45 billion, some people were talking much less, some people were talking, you know, it could be in a whole lot of Swiss banks, it could be everywhere, but...
Well, he's not spending it at the moment, that's for sure,
that's
stuck
for
where
sure.
He is.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Millions of regular Press TV viewers will recognize our next guest. He's Yusuf El-Halou, one of the courageous few based permanently in Gaza, who probably has spent more time than most journalists reporting under fire.
Yusuf, it's always a pleasure to have you on board HMS President, but your trip to London this time has been tinged with great sadness, hasn't it?
Yes, I lost three members of my family, relatives, two children below the age of 15, and their grandfather. They were playing outside their home, and when these tank shells landed on them, it was a sad event, of course. You know, if I was in Gaza, I would have reported about the loss of my own family. I believe that this will not be the last. I mean,
these are Israeli airstrikes and targeting, in this case, unarmed civilians. I mean, you must be looking at events unfolding in Libya and wishing that you could have a no-fly zone back at your home.
Well, I think the recent Israeli escalation in Gaza will push the Palestinians towards more despair and hopelessness, and this has been going on for decades. The NATO should impose no-fly zone over Palestine to protect the civilians, because, you know, my people have been under occupation for over six decades and under Israeli siege for over 4 years. And it's really weird how the international community is not taking serious action.
Those journalists who would talk about, say, the bomb in Jerusalem and say, let's lead on that story and forget about your relatives who were killed, they say they're not biased.
Well, again, it's the hypocrisy and the double standard policy. You know, they think the Palestinian blood is cheap. And it's unfortunate, you know, how they can allow Israel get away with its crimes. Israel enjoys a culture of impunity, and this because of the blind American support.
They're very quiet on Libya, aren't they? I just wanted to say, they're very quiet on Libya, Israel. They weren't invited to the Libya conference here in London.
Well, I think they are watching and monitoring the event closely, and they are worried for losing, you know, maybe another lie. After Mubarak was ousted, now they are looking for more allies, and they are worried now from the new Egyptian foreign minister, who promised that he will take more steps to ease the suffering of Gazans under siege.
Now, while you've been over here, you've been meeting some new friends, old faces. I gather that you've met some people from the next flotilla, which is due to go out in May.
Yes, this flotilla will set sail on the 31st of May to mark the first anniversary of the attack on the Mav Marmara, and they are actually looking very forward to be in Gaza. They now say that it's our duty to break the naval blockade. Israel is not actually allowing fishermen to fish freely, and it's ironic now that they are thinking to build an artificial island, 4x2 island, to allow Gazans to trade it. So it seems that Israel is trying to tell the world that it's not in control of Gaza anymore.
Well, thank you, Yusuf. I know you'll continue to be telling the world about what's happening in Gaza.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Okay.
Syria, Jordan and Yemen keep making and breaking the headline news, but the one constant throughout has been Libya, as the rebels and Colonel Gaddafi swing backwards and forwards, advancing and retreating in what seems to some to be an intractable war.
But the unexpected arrival of the Libyan Foreign Minister, Moussa Koussa, is being hailed as a major milestone by the British government. However, our final guest, Dr. Roger Cottrell, a military intelligence analyst and expert on the Middle East, urges extreme caution.
Roger, welcome to HMS President. Hi. Why the pessimism? The British government seems to be hailing this as a victory, although they were unsure whether he was actually in Britain.
Well, let's be really honest. The British government has not really been very enthusiastic about this revolution in Libya. These tremendous events, of course, have come out of
the... They like the bombing.
Well, I'll come to that in a moment. Do they like the bombing? Actually, I would say that Gaddafi's troops were already in the suburbs of Benghazi before any kind of military... I personally support the military airstrikes in defence of the rebels, but I think that the support of the British government is very, very conditional. They waited until till the rebellion was on the back foot. They waited till the Saudis moved into Bahrain, and we've heard very little about that. And quite frankly, I think that from day one, yes, they've offered a certain amount of support, shamed by their previous role in arming the...
The Foreign Secretary seems quite happy because he uses it as something to beat Tony Blair up in the Labour opposition party here by saying you cozied up to Gaddafi, not the Tories.
Well, let's be honest. I mean, there hasn't been that much change between the two governments. The important thing is, I think, that the British government are looking to basically secure a deal between the rebels and some elements within the regime. And clearly, this defection, which is what it effectively is part of that process. He comes to this country and he's in a safe house somewhere at the same time that other Libyan envoys from the Libyan government have come into the United Kingdom. This, our own government has not recognised the transitional government in Benghazi as being a provisional government of Libya. They're saying that the arms embargo actually applies to both sides. We've been there before with Bosnia. Basically, what we're looking at is basically a stitch-up, a negotiated settlement to try and hold the revolution in its tracks.
But why all the celebration about the arrival of the former foreign minister, the defection? I mean, judging from the headlines today, he's a nasty piece of work. Should Britain really have welcomed him?
Not at all. This man's got blood on his hands. If you're a foreign minister, an ex-intelligence head in a society like Libya, that doesn't mean you say go on junkets to sell to trade. It means that, for example, this is a person who was targeted. Libyan dissidents have been murdered in this country in the past. And this is a man with blood on his hands. And all the celebration, well, there's two kinds of things. One, obviously people on the ground in eastern Libya, the rebels are going to be pleased that there's yet another crack in the Gaddafi regime. The edifice is crumbling. At that level, anything like that is good news. But I think the only people really celebrating over here are our own government that want to sell the revolution down the river.
Your background is military intelligence. What sort of things will he be questioned about now? Because we're told he's in the hands of
MI6. Yeah. Okay, he'll be questioned about his role in supporting terrorism outside of Libya. He will be asked about his role in targeting Libyan dissidents in this country. Those are the two most important things he'll be asked about. If one operates on the assumption that that Lockerbie was indeed down to the Libyans, and I actually favour Coleman's position myself, I think the Syrians were behind that. Another country where things are going on at the moment. But if they still think that was down to Libya, then he'll be questioned about that because it would have happened on his watch. So they're the kind of questions.
He's being questioned in secret. A lot of people would say that MI6 have a lot of involvement with the Gaddafi regime. It's very murky. I don't know, I watched a film about Carlos the Jackal the other day. He said he could bring Gaddafi down with a couple of words because Gaddafi's hands have been everywhere throughout foreign policy over these decades.
Absolutely.
And involvement in secret agents from the United States.
Well, let us not forget that Edmund Wilson, who was who actually created the Libyan General Intelligence Directorate in the form that we know it, was a renegade ex-CIA man. He actually had trained the Iranian Savak under the Shah, and it was very often mooted that to what extent was he renegade and to what extent was he still keeping...
But he's in a safe house somewhere around here. How do we know the general public will hear what he has to say?
Well, we won't. I mean, that's why these things take place in secret. We won't know. We can only speculate. But given what we know about the history of these kind of events and how these things work, things haven't changed that much from the Cold War. When you get someone who's a defector, you debrief them in that kind of way. And of course, historically, what has happened is that defectors have always told the people who they're being interviewed by what they want to hear, because they're looking to cut a deal. I mean, he can't go back to Libya now. If this all goes pear-shaped, he's got to look at some kind of blue-chip exile. So therefore, he is going to tell his debriefing team exactly what they want to hear.
Roger, thank you very much for your views.
Well, if you want to know more about today's guests, go onto our website, www.ritansiandridley.com. And don't forget, we're also on Twitter and Facebook.
See you at the same time, same place next week.